K-12 is at a pivotal moment. Leaders are tackling academic recovery and equity amidst teacher shortages and a growing school choice movement. Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of Talking Out of School, the podcast where superintendents, principals, and other key figures in education share their goals and strategies for moving K-12 forward. I'm Matt Zelaznik, senior writer at District Administration, and I'm joined by my colleague Micah Ward, an education reporter here at DA. Today, we're excited to be joined by Dr. Javaid Siddiqui, the president and CEO of the Hunt Institute and the former Virginia Secretary of Education. He's leading the nonprofit's work on teacher recruitment, school choice, and literacy, among other pressing K-12 issues. Let's start with the Hunt Institute's work on teacher recruitment and retention. How are you helping districts stabilize their workforces, particularly when it comes to making sure the educators are as diverse as their students?
Yeah, well, so we've been leading with some colleagues and friends in the field. We have seven other partner organizations co-leading this really with our friends at TNTP. This campaign around educator diversity, or 1 Million Teachers of Color, is our sort of functional title. It was really born out of the work we've done here in North Carolina, charged or led by at the behest of Governor Cooper, who wanted to, his administration wanted to lean into addressing this diversity issue, workforce diversity issue. And so we started working with a team here in North Carolina, looking at North Carolina data. Clearly, when you start working with districts and state leaders in one state, you want to have an appreciation for what's out there. You know, what are other states doing? What are other districts dealing with and grappling with? And so we looked at we always start, our sort of strategy is always, let's look at the neighbors first. So, you know, Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, South Carolina, what does their sort of landscape look like? And we're looking at their data, we're like, oh, this is okay, this is a bigger problem. And so we stepped back and looked at, you know, who are the leaders and laggards, which is the secondary, sort of second step in our process of trying to figure out how pervasive any issue is. Oh, this is an issue in many states. Oh, this is an issue in California? Because, you know, when we think California, we think super diverse, super liberal, very teacher friendly. Why is California have such a delta between what the student demographics look like and what the teacher demographics look like? And as a quick aside, we've now obviously gone a little further. It's also 1 million teachers of color, but it's also 30,000 school leaders of color. And those are the numbers as we've collected the data now based on this, we're being compelled. You know, certainly we wanted to address the governor's issues in North Carolina, but we saw an opportunity and we knew we couldn't address this alone. So we went to our friends at TNTP, and then we added some others from the rest of our standing work committee to try to tackle this problem. And so what we know now, as we've looked at aggregating the data, is we need 1 million teachers of color and 30,000 school leaders of color to ensure our classrooms and our buildings are representative of the communities they're serving. And so we've tried to engage with state leaders, district leaders, especially our bigs. You know, you want to get the big districts engaged. And so we are hosting and facilitating convenings of state lawmakers where we invite state district superintendents, certainly state superintendents, to come and be part of this conversation, lifting up grow your own programs, you know, so specific solutions that are being put in place in very local ways. So lawmakers can hear how different districts are leaning into this issue. But we also knew we had to educate, well, why is this a big issue? Like, you know, candidly, we've confronted questions from some folks, and maybe specifically one party, and specifically more of the South. And that gets into, you think, started getting to the racial tensions of it all. We're not saying this is a race issue. In fact, the research tells us quite the contrary, that all students, even white students, benefit from having at least one teacher of color of record. Black students, you know, the data is much more pronounced. Having one black teacher before third grade increases college attendance by 13% to 33%. So the data has also told us this is a problem. let alone from, you know, wanting kids to see themselves in classrooms. And so context is important. We recognize every state is and every law, you know, pretty much all lawmakers are dealing with teacher compensation and teacher shortage issues. And the issues always come back to compensation, only compensation. We're saying there's a mine, untapped mine of talent in every state. In California, as I mentioned earlier, it seems to be a really, not to pick on it, but it's an interesting story because 11% of them, over 139,000 teachers of color are needed in California to ensure the classrooms are representative of the community they're serving. So if California is not getting it right, it's not a Democrat-Republican issue, it's a national issue. And it's a local issue all at the same time. So how do we get local leaders, state leaders, and federal leaders engaged? And that's why we're excited that, you know, the Secretary and the Biden-Harris folks have leaned into this. And Secretary Cardona is making this a priority of his administration and is putting, you know, his time into this issue. And his administration has been very engaged on this front, and we're grateful for their partnership.
So if I'm a superintendent in California or Arkansas, what could I do like this week or next week? Or this, I think this is kind of a hiring season. What would you tell me to do if I called and asked you for help?
Well, I think there's some quick low-hanging fruit are, you know, looking at having conversations with folks that have scaled up Grow Your Own programs and districts. Some states have put in some apprenticeship programs. Our friend David Donaldson is doing some really good work with this National Grow Your Own initiative. Commissioner Schwinn, Penny Schwinn in Tennessee, before she left, and the Governor Lee put in a place an apprenticeship program that's going to engage a whole host of talent in a way, bring them into the workforce. They're going to be more likely to be people of color. And so I think we're trying to, if you're coming into the conversation with the issue of, I have a shortage issue and we have a talent issue, we believe, well, we can help you because this is a community that is not represented. And here's this data that tells us that if you engage this community, this is going to help you on your student learning outcomes. Oh, and also this mine of talent is a lot deeper. So we win on both fronts. We're helping you solve your shortage issue, and you're also helping student outcomes because you're allowing the classes to become more reflective of the community. So I think Grow Your Own is one that easily comes to mind. I think having conversations with district leaders that have done these things and solve these problems, we want to try to network. And that's part of what we're doing is creating this network of leaders. One of our steering committee members is MCEL, Men of Color in Education Leadership, and Harrison Peters, I'm sure you know. And that is a network of deans and district leaders of color that are trying to make, you know, trying to increase representation of leaders of color in the field. And so I think the more leaders of color we get in the field, the more likely we're going to both retain and also recruit more teachers of color into the field. And there's some data behind that as well. And I think just getting people aware of the data, so they come into the conversation when it's shortage, but they hear the data and everybody to a person and hears this data. Emotion, you can just see it. It's a visceral reaction. They may come into the conversation around shortage, but they leave feeling a sense of responsibility. When I say to them, and I recall, you know, speaking at an event at the White House, it was a convening of Black leaders around equity issues in education. And, you know, I shared one of my favorite data points is 40% of all schools in America do not have a single teacher of color. It's just sort of like just palpable. You know, you could just hear the gasping is audible. And I think if that community is not aware of the data, clearly there's some work that we have. The hill is much bigger than we thought. So I think just educating people and getting people aware, you see district leaders sort of walking away feeling, you can just see that there's a light switch and there's a sense of responsibility. And so we're trying to increase the responsibility dynamic by bringing more people into the fold to help us be part of the solution. And I think hopefully they're thinking about it in a very emotional way, because that's what will hopefully help them with the responsibility front.
Excellent. Shifting gears a little bit, a lot of the superintendents we talk to say school choice has heightened the competition for students. Is this a good thing for public schools?
Yeah, well, school choice refers broadly to families, you know, the ability for a family to choose their school that their child attends, and the ability to draw public funding to do so. This encompasses many options. Charter schools is one that, you know, invariably comes to mind. Magnet schools, intra or inter-district transfers, private schools, vouchers, where it gets a little, that's where it starts getting really sticky, and certainly education ESAs or education savings accounts. So, you know, on one hand, school choice offers families more, you know, voice in their children's education. But the question indicates, or, you know, advocates claim choice programs provide opportunities for new and different education models to develop or create competitive pressures on the traditional system. And, you know, sort of for schools and districts to potentially innovate and improve. So in short, it pushes schools to provide the best education for students. That's sort of the thinking. That is not always what the reality is in application. But, you know, my position and, you know, our position is we've tried to not really get into whether we are pro-school choice or anti-school choice, because we've seen for every successful public school, there's a not so successful public school. For every successful charter school, there's a not, you know, there's sort of things that they're equally impactful. You know, it's not a all charters are bad or all charters are great. It's not, but certainly all public, you know, traditionals are great. That's not the case. And I've been in, you know, almost every type of school you could think of. And I've been in charter schools where the population was 100%, you know, free lunch. Windows were broken. And yet I saw, you know, the data and the student, I recall seeing four-year-olds walking or, you know, engaging in their alphabet and learning how to, you know, the learning how to read in a place where the reading literacy rates were abysmal. And so we know when you engage young people in a meaningful way, in a way that you believe they're going to learn. So that was a charter school. And I've been in a number of charter schools that were engaging disproportionately Black, Hispanic, low income learners that were finding success. But I've also been in some charter schools where you could tell the organization wasn't there, the leadership wasn't there, and therefore the student outcomes were not coming to bear. Now, they didn't always shut down, but they were easier to shut down. And so what I know right now, politically, and we do some public polling around this, have done for the last 3 years, is parents, and we poll prospective voters, likely voters, Republicans, Democrats, and Independents, and disproportionately, almost to a parent, over 70-80% of our 78-80%, I think it's the data point, indicate they want to have more voice in their students' learning and their students' academic choices. Where it gets a little muddy nowadays is around, you know, you start adding in the stone's throw away from banned books, or should we offer AP African American history, and should we teach African American history? Like those are the noise of it all. We do need to figure out how we get parents more engaged in classrooms. District leaders need to feel that responsibility. That doesn't mean, because most of our kids are going to be served in traditional, we can't open enough charters to give parents, every parent, a choice. We're not going to do that, and not going to do it overnight. We're not going to do it over the next 10 years. Even if we had 100% buy-in, it's not going to happen. It's not realistic. So we have to figure out how we get more parents engagement and offer parents more voice in a traditional setting. I think if district leaders spent their time thinking about inviting parents in, they actually would combat some of this emerging sort of desire to have voice. The reality is voice exists, and PTAs are these partners that have sort of membership has faded. I'd like to see both, you know, the principals individually and principals associations, and certainly the national group, all same with superintendents. I'd like to see them working a little bit more intentionally with the parent association and rebuild that relationship in a way that is functional. Now, there are examples of that dynamic working very well, but for every great example, there's probably 10 not great examples. And so the parents need to feel that voice and that opportunity to be engaged. And there's easy, subtle ways to do it. So I, you know, when people want to make it the charter traditional, or, you know, vouchers traditional, or voucher, you know, choice, not choice, it's really, we need district leaders to make parents feel like they have a choice by allowing them to be engaged in their kids' educational outcomes. Because most parents are going to defer to the community school because that's where we live. I want my kid to go to be able to walk to school or be able to have a 15-minute bus ride rather than an hour and a half bus ride. Or I don't want to have to drive them to, you know, those are real kitchen table conversations that parents don't want to confront. The most functional way is to make sure the school is making me feel like I'm involved and I have a voice.
Got it. You touched on this a little bit. Our superintendents we talked to are also concerned about how prepared or not prepared students are starting kindergarten, first grade. Are we making progress around early childhood and preschool? And what's the Hunt Institute have to offer to help?
Yeah, I think we've made tremendous progress over the last 10 years. We've been leaning in heavily in regards to building lawmakers' capacity around the importance of early childhood education. We've dissociated sort of this idea that this early child care, that, you know, we got to remove that from people's sort of schema. This is not about child care. Child care is important. But when we talk about learning as academics or educators, we got to be thinking about it as education. It's early childhood education. Those are the most formidable. I mean, actually, I'm a K-12 guy. I will tell you that the bang for the buck, the return on investment is happening in the first 0 to 18 months, 0 to 3 years. The conversations, if you recall, 10, 15 years ago, have really been around, and they still exist today around the importance of, you know, learning to read or reading to learn, learning to read, reading to learn, third grade reading tests. And that being a really, you know, data point that resonated. Republicans all were eating it up on those third grade, you know, you recall the social promotion that was like the thing that was sweeping across the country, 99 to 2005, 2010. And it's still laws that exist around social promotion because it was tied to No Child Left Behind. And what we found was we introduced a static line. Every child has got to read, be able to read to learn by third grade. They got to be able to be assigned a text, determine if they can sort of decode that text, interact with that text, determine what's important, synthesize a thought in a written form, or be able to answer a set of questions from that text. So were they capable of reading on grade level? So that was a static line. What we didn't consider is families that were sending their kids, you know, you've heard the million word gap where some families growing up in more fortunate means, those kids are being, are hearing a million more words before their low-income counterparts. And so how do we address the starting line? Because the starting line has traditionally been, hell, in most states is kindergarten, but there are a few states it's first grade. They still don't even require kindergarten. It's not compulsory. So let's associate the kindergarten as a sort of start line. Well, we know we have a hard static finish line at third grade. What we've done over the last several years, 10 years, is really tried to deconstruct the starting line and help electives on both sides of the aisle understand that this starting line has to be fluid. We have to look at the circumstances. So with context matters. Poverty is the driver in that meeting success at that static line of third grade. And we've seen a lot of, you know, Republicans really introduce legislation in the last couple of years here around expanding access. Now they're putting some parameters on it. You know, there are states like, and I know New York is leaning in on universal preschool. And I'm not anti-universal preschool, but I think there's got to be a targeted approach to it. And I think there's got to be a way to scale up. It's hard to ask for it. Let's send everybody to this pre-K if not everybody needs it, so why are we going to go create a battle over money? Because that's really what it comes down to, right? We're not required to pay for it. The research tells us, though, that pre-K is probably one of the best investments we can make. And I think about October, Governor Pritzker announced a proposal to create a unified early childhood state agency that will create a common sort of governance system for its approach in support of families, providers, and promoting equity. And while increasing funding into the early childhood programs in state, including that what they have is their Smart Start pre-K. So there are things happening in pre-K. That Smart Start really was born out of, and this is one of the things that Governor Hunt is really known for. If anybody really knows Governor Hunt's sort of education, he's sort of the education governor, but he really is the early education governor, because that Smart Start model has been sort of stolen and replicated across the country. So we're looking at alternatives. Like in here in North Carolina, we have some funding like the TriShare, which, you know, we're going to be piloting here in North Carolina. So I look forward to maybe reporting out. But they're looking at how subsidies are reimbursed currently by market rate, moving to a true cost of care model, because that delta, as we come out of this pandemic and these ARPA ESSER dollars, those dollars are going to land back on families, and that burden is going to, providers are going to struggle to be able to pay, you know, basically keep their lights on, you know, being able to operate because they've been subsidized. And so how do we continue those things that have served families very well? But in the end, to answer your question, I feel much better today than I did a few years ago. I'm pleasantly surprised at where we are. If you would have asked me 3 years ago where we would we be here, I would probably not have thought that. But I see a lot less partisan nonsense in this investment area. But there's still a lot of work to be done.
Well, that's good to hear. And I know you mentioned literacy a lot in that statement. And there's been a lot of conversations surrounding the science of reading in recent years. What is the Hunt Institute doing to help districts to further implement this model?
So we've been working for the last several years. This is year three. Our project is called The Path Forward. We've been convening folks from the state agencies, so state superintendents, flagship deans of educator prep programs, governor's office staff, you know, so senior educator policy staff, and a couple of lawmakers, legislators from the state, coming together as a state team to really look at their state context. We've convened them virtually for a year. That's how we sort of introduce them to a core model. They come together with six other states, or five other states, six at a time. We look at a state like, we really emerged from, you know, what happened in Mississippi. Mississippi went from, you know, bottom two or three on, depending on the year, in regards to literacy outcomes, to being now a national leader with respect by incorporating the science of reading. So we took that model and we convened these leaders to start having these conversations, and we've seen the dynamic and the synergy improve dramatically. It's fascinating how, you know, folks in the same state, they don't talk to each other. Sometimes they work in the same building, and sometimes we're right down the hall from each other. So creating a cohort model, allowing for role of lifetime, allowing from in here from national leaders. So we've assembled a national advisory board of, you know, some of the best practitioners and academics, researchers around the science of reading. And we've helped them sort of connect with policies that have advanced outcomes for young people. And so what we've seen now by convening, we've convened three years. So we have 18 states. We have an annual summit. The folks that were in Core 1, we invite back. Into Core 2, they're going to get invited back to our national summit this July. But I think this is a model that we're going to have to probably pivot from, because what we've seen from these states is we've gone from a couple states doing it to now over 33 states have now, there's been sweeping legislation across the country. So now I think over 33, it's definitely 32, maybe 33 states that have some type of comprehensive literacy legislation that has been implemented or passed in the last year, two, three. And so now what we're dealing with is the implementation challenge. And, you know, that's always the, you know, sort of the brass tacks of it all, right? So the in Virginia, for example, bipartisan group of, you know, we convene lawmakers annually in Virginia through an education retreat. And a few years ago, House Republican female got together with a female Senate African-American Democrat, and they ran a bipartisan Virginia Literacy Act. Now, they've, for the last two years, they've gone in and, you know, sort of tweaked some things, but it was 3 years ago they got it passed in a bipartisan way. And now districts are required, universities are required. This is the way university faculty should be teaching teacher candidates how to teach young people to read. District leaders need to make sure their classroom teachers are teaching in an evidence-based way, and so implementing science to reading. But what we know is when the brass tacks of it all is classroom teachers are going to close the door and likely do what they've always done. So we're working on now, we're pivoting our strategy around how do we tackle the implementation challenge. And so the model was, let's create some national leaders, like state leaders. Like Mississippi was getting a lot of attention, and that's great. And Kerry Wright deserves a lot of credit for that. But how do we create more Kerry Wrights? That was sort of the model. How do we get more state superintendents leading on this and carrying the message on this? So we've actually said, maybe we need to think about going into the states that are struggling with the implementation and create district leaders. So we're going to be now working with bringing together and maybe a district superintendent or two from each of the way these states are, you know, typically deconstructed is like a superintendent's region, you know, 5, 8, 10, whatever, how big the state is. They break the state up into regions and they create these little regions of superintendents or regions of districts. And so we're going to try to work within maybe identify one or two district leaders in each of the regions to implement some models around, you know, creating exemplars again. So if you live in County X and County Y is doing this great work, it's going to hopefully hit the local media, local press, parents, your soccer teams. You get together your kids in this county and your kid goes to school in this county. Well, this is how my kid's learning to read. You start hearing data outcomes. It's likely going to spur change. That's what we did with the path forward. And we've now, like I said, now we have over 32 states that have done this because we were now telling the story of these states that had implemented some, whether they were regulatory changes or in fact legislative changes. When we go and have these legislative convenings or meeting with governors or future governors, they hear that and they want to bring that legislation to their state. So the thinking is district superintendents will hear of those successes happening in the neighboring districts. They'll want to really implement that model and hold accountable to what's happening in the classroom.
Sounds good. I think that wraps up our time. Thanks for your insight.
Yeah, it's good to meet both of you. Thanks for your time.
That's it for another episode of Talking Out of School. We thank you for joining us. Be sure to visit districtadministration.com, where you can find all of our previous podcasts and fresh articles addressing the most pressing topics in K-12 district leadership. And please subscribe to our DA Daily newsletter.